not only before June 30th, but over the rest of the year after June 30th?
I think the force, again, I don't like to waffle in my answers, and this will sound like a waffle to you, but it depends on a couple of different things. It depends upon the enemy. Although I would predict, and I think Rick will agree with me, that the situation will become more violent even after sovereignty, because it will remain unclear what's going to happen between the interim government and election. So moving through the election period will be violent, and it could very well be more violent than we're seeing today. So it's possible that we might need more forces. But I would again say that perhaps with a resolution in the United Nations, that instead of forces withdrawing from Iraq, that they come to Iraq, because international nations need to understand how important Iraq's stability is for their future as well as the entire region's future. So getting more international forces, getting a higher quality of Iraqi force will help figure out where we stand. But I think the numbers about where we are now for the foreseeable future, unless something changes either international force-wise or in the quality of Iraqi troops, is what we can expect through the elections.
What did you mean by a long time?
Well, we know the elections will take place in December or January. So am I saying that the 1st Armored don't get me in any more trouble with the 1st Armored Division and the 2nd Armored Cav. I mean, we will rotate them out of there, but the force levels will stay about what they are, I think, until after the elections.
Thank you,
Senator.
Or
until we come to the point where we see that we're going to have a soft landing.
Thank you very much, Senator. Senator Akaka.
This is Senator Daniel Akaka of Hawaii.
I want to add my gratitude to you in praise and commendation to your leadership, as well as to our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. I, too, have visited Iraq and Afghanistan, and the kind of message I got while I was there was good. And our troops seem to have been working well at that time. And I've been very concerned about one part of the personnel that's there. We have talked about our international and coalition forces. We've talked about the MPs, the MIs. One group are the contractors, and this has been mentioned here. And it seems as though, and I seem to sense that, and I'd like to get an answer from you on this, that the contractors seem to be outside of the line of command. That's my feeling. And as a result, some things they do are not known by us. General Abizaid, it is my understanding that the civilian contractors who are interrogators, there are many different kinds, interrogators work directly with military intelligence personnel. My question is, who supervises the civilian interrogators, do they report to any agencies other than DOD? Another question is anyone in DOD accountable for the behavior of the civilian contractors?
Sir, if I could, I'd like
General
to take
Miller,
this.
Thank you.
The civilian contractors who work in our intelligence organizations are accountable to the chain of command of the intelligence organization. So if you're an interrogator, you're accountable to the chain of command of the interrogation company or the battalion or the brigade that goes in here. And so there are also people who do screening. By screening, I mean when you come in to the, you're captured, they do the initial debriefing to be able to develop intelligence. And we have a small number who are in our intelligence fusion centers. They all work for the military in through here. In our organization currently, no civilian contractor is in a supervisory position. It's the military who has the priority, who sets the priorities and ensures that we meet our standards.
What other types of personnel do you have there as contractors besides interrogators who are contractors?
So in the intelligence area, there are the screeners, those who get initial information. And that's not an interrogation. And those who are involved in intelligence fusion, developing intelligence from processed intelligence, from raw intelligence, and feeding our computer systems, those are the contractors that we have in the intelligence system.
You'll also find interpreters, Senator.
Thank you. Now, then my question on that is, are there any contractors who are from third world nations?
I am sure there are, yes. I've talked to some.
Sir, our translators, some of them are from third world nations. They do an excellent job for us.
Can you name some of the nations?
Sir, I'm sorry, I cannot.
Yes, and my concern has been, thank you for answering it, that they are within the line and chain of command, so that we know what they're doing and they're answerable to someone in DOD.
So we will, for the record, we will get the nations that those interpreters are from.
Thank you very much. General Miller, you've had quite a bit of publicity. And so let me ask you this out of my curiosity. Did you tell General Karpinski that you were going to jitmoize Abu Ghraib? And my question is, what did you mean by the statement?
Yeah. Senator, I did not tell General Karpinski I was going to jitmoize Abu Ghraib. I don't believe I've ever used that term, ever. When General Karpinski and I were having our dialogues, they were about humane detention, how the detention centers would be run, the requirements for the military police, and the leadership to be present to ensure that humane detention is done. As we've talked about before, it is an enormously high leader impact, high leader touch requirement.
And my concern there, do you think it is possible that any of your recommendations could have been misconstrued by the civilian contractors?
Senator, I do not believe that any of those recommendations were misconstrued. At that time, there were no civilian contractors employed in the organization, but they were on their way to be coming. But once again, that would be speculation on my part because I was not there during the hiring and how the civilian contractors came.
General Abizaid, you discussed the need to modify Army doctrine. About Abu Ghraib, and you cited instances of abuse in Afghanistan and Iraq. Is the problem of detainee abuse systemic within CENTCOM?
No, sir, I do not believe it's systemic. There have been instances of abuse in Afghanistan and other prisons, as you know, in Iraq as well. I believe my comments concerning doctrine have to do more with how we fuse intelligence, how we distribute intelligence, how we work in a synchronized manner to achieve results that will help our young soldiers on the battlefield and Marines.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Senator Akaka. We've had an excellent hearing. Very thorough exchange of views and responses. We thank you. We'll now reassemble in the Intelligence Committee tonight. Wait a minute.
Mr. Chairman, just very briefly, yes. I appreciate the opportunity, and I think I'll, if we're going to go into closed, I'll withhold my questions. Just a very brief statement, though. I do want to associate myself with some of the concerns that Senator Inhofe raised. Since there is so much that you don't know whether you
this
know it or not.
This is Senator Talent of Missouri who has who's just suddenly appeared in the room.
One of the worst things that can happen out of this is if we ended up in a situation where some of these people got off, you know, the people that we ultimately determine are responsible because of something that was said at one of these hearings. In addition, the fact that I think there's something to be said for waiting until you all can present a comprehensive the comprehensive results of your investigations. I do want to just, for the record, Mr. Chairman, respectfully suggest to you and the ranking member that we consider whether it would be good to have the Fay report in hand before we do the next hearing. I know you are talking constantly with the ranking member about timing and what we ought to do, and I think these hearings have been very good. But it almost comports with the Senate schedule anyway, given that a recess is coming up. Other than that, Mr. Chairman, I'll withhold until the
Senator, in my discussions with the Department of Defense, which has, I may say, been very cooperative,
yeah.
They have indicated that this committee will be the first to receive the Fay report when it is available.
Yeah, if it looks like they're stonewalling all, I think it's a different thing. But if you think in a couple of weeks, then that's the report I think it's
the Department will determine the timing of the release of that report.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And again, I thank you very much. We'll go to 219 for a closed session. And I thank the committee. I take note that we have had a 100% attendance here today. I think that speaks to the seriousness and the solemnity with which this committee regards this very serious issue.
Mr. Chairman, I just would want to clarify one, not by asking a question, though, by thanking our witnesses joining you, but also indicating that I have some additional questions.
This is Senator Levin.
Classified that we don't have time to ask,
right.
But which I will be submitting to our witnesses. And I think if the chairman would set a deadline for those so our witnesses won't have to be troubled by questions coming in for a long period of time, for instance, questions within the next 24 hours or 48 hours would be very helpful. But I do want to respect your time.
Absolutely.
Would that
thank
be all right?
You. That would be fine. Let's
48
just,
hours,
let's just establish midday Friday.
That'd be fine. Yep. Noon Friday.
Noon Friday. Thank you very much.
You're listening to live coverage of hearings before the Senate Armed Services Committee from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer, and I'm here with Mary Louise Kelly. We've been watching today three generals and a senior JAG, Judge Advocate General officer, testify before the Senate Armed Services Committee about the abuses of prisoners in Iraq. Mary Louise, the first, right away, let's just talk about the Fay report, which we've heard a number of references to. One of the senators just suggested that perhaps hearings should be postponed until the Fay report is in hand. Tell us what it is, who's conducting it, and how this is different from all of the other investigations that have been going on.
General Fay is a senior Army intelligence officer. He has been charged with looking specifically into what was going on in the military intelligence chain of command. So trying to sort out who knew what when, who may have issued what sort of orders, what was going on in military intelligence that may have led to the abuses at Abu Ghraib. We've been told that report is due sometime very soon, hopefully within the next couple of weeks. We heard Senator Warner, the chair of this committee, saying that they have been promised by the Pentagon this committee will be the first to get it. And as you say, yes, there were so many questions here today that we heard the witnesses saying, you know, that's something General Fay will get to in his report. I can't quite answer that question now. Let's wait and see what General Fay says, what the result of his inquiry is. That, yes, one of the senators here today, Senator Talent, said maybe we shouldn't hold another hearing until we hear back from General Fay. So all eyes are sort of on that report as the next thing coming in that may help clarify some of these questions.
Now, the three generals who were here today, General John Abizaid of Central Command, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, who is the senior commander in Iraq, and Major General Jeffrey Miller, who is the deputy commanding general for detainee operations in Iraq, are all obviously well able to speak to the question of prisoner abuse. But I have to say that I'm not sure that the amount of knowledge that we have about why this happened has been greatly expanded. Some things have been clarified. The generals were indicating that most of the International Committee of the Red Cross reports that were issued, have been cited as reasons why the military ought to have understood earlier that they had a problem. Most of those reports appear to have to do with when detainees are initially arrested, which is to say not by cops but captured, basically, by troops, that the International Committee of the Red Cross has suggested that some of these people have been roughly treated at the point where they're captured.
The method of dealing with these Red Cross reports, as you say, was one of the points that emerged. General Abizaid talked about that this is something that specific that they have identified needs to be fixed. He said the system is broken right now. There is no clear central repository for where these reports come in. The ICRC, as we now know, was documenting prisoner abuses, problems with the detainee system in Iraq early last year and then throughout the year into early 2004 this year. And those reports, it's not clear that they were reaching the people and the level of command that they needed to be reaching. So, as I say, General Abizaid identified that as one very specific thing that needs to be fixed.
Another specific fact that I thought was sort of difficult to understand how significant it is that General Sanchez said that the report issued by General Tacuba was, which said that General Sanchez had placed the Abu Ghraib prison under control of military intelligence, was not, strictly speaking, correct. General Sanchez says that, in fact, he had the prison placed under military intelligence because he was concerned that it was not being properly defended against attacks from without the prison by the military police, so that military intelligence would be in a better position to do that.
This has been a point of confusion in today's hearing. We heard this as a point of stark disagreement in last week's hearing between the Undersecretary for Intelligence, Stephen Cambone, the Defense Undersecretary for Intelligence, and General Tacuba himself, disagreeing on what exactly this order means. What they're referring to is General Sanchez, last November, November 19th, issued a fragmentary order, it's called, that put tactical control of the prison of Abu Ghraib under military intelligence and its commander of the 205th Brigade, Colonel Pappas. The Tacuba report concluded that that meant that the Abu Ghraib was therefore under the control of military intelligence. Today we heard the senators pressing and trying to get clarification on this, and General Sanchez saying no, military police stayed in control of logistics, of training, of the operation of the prison, and when pressed on it said, yes, I disagree with the conclusion reached in the Tacuba report.
We got a very kind of sedate picture of what interrogation ought to have been like from General Miller under the rules of the rules of the Geneva Convention, talking about humane treatment and so forth, as if the sorts of abuses we were talking about did not exist. Sort of an implication, I guess, would have to say that we're talking about bad apples here.
This is one of the central questions here. Are we dealing with a few bad apples? Are we dealing with some sort of systemic pattern of abuse? We heard all three of the generals today testifying that there was no systemic pattern of abuse. This is something we'll have to clear up in future hearings.
You've been listening to NPR's live coverage before the Senate Armed Services Committee. Our thanks to Mary Louise Kelly for joining us today. Our engineer is Tony Marchito, and our producer is Jeff Rosenberg. From the Hart Senate Office Building, I'm Linda Wertheimer. This is NPR News.
And this is AM 580 WILL Urbana, public radio coming to you from the campus of the University of Illinois. Good morning. I'm David Inge. Now we'll get back to something of our regular schedule here. And in the time remaining, as we often do when we have hearings like these or special events coverage and we have a little bit of time, we give you the opportunity to tell us what you think and to share your thoughts with other people who are listening. If you've been listening to the hearings this morning and you have comments on what's been said, or on the general issue of the abuse of Iraqi prisoners, or I suppose for that matter on Iraq, we can open things up here to open line and spend some time in conversation. The number, as always, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. So your comments, thoughts, questions are certainly welcome, particularly if you have some thoughts on how on this program we can continue to discuss this issue. We did take our first attempt last week, and it was a program that we did on Thursday. It was kind of hastily arranged. We thought there was something here that certainly we should be discussing, particularly some questions about international law, the Geneva Convention, the rules of treatment of prisoners. And so we found a guest who was a law professor at a university in California who's had some expertise on international law, and we had her on the program. And we got some comments from people who thought that that was a good program. We also heard from at least one listener who was very upset with the what he thought were the apparent biases of the guest and how that reflected on our own bias. And he made some comments about our continuing tilt to the left and bias against the administration and against the war. So what we want to try to do, particularly this summer, I'm sure we'll have the opportunity to talk some more about Iraq and about the Middle East. And we do want to present, and we intend to make every effort to present a range of opinions so that you will hear some different and some for and some against. But we're certainly interested in your thoughts about how we can follow up on these issues, what we have done so far. And, of course, it is an opportunity for comments and an open forum if you'd like to call in and share some of your ideas with us. Again, it's, as always, the local number, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. A reminder that coming up today as part of the afternoon magazine, Celeste Quinn will be talking with science journalist Wendy Orent. She's the author of a book titled Plague, The Mysterious Past and Terrifying Future of the World's Most Dangerous Disease. In the final years of the Soviet regime, Soviet scientists apparently created antibiotic-resistant strains of plague for use as biological weapons. On the show today, some conversation about that disease, its history, and its potential as use as a weapon. Celeste, again, talks with Wendy Orent, a science journalist. So that's coming up today as part of the afternoon magazine. The usual time for the interview, that's the 1 o'clock hour. The show itself gets underway at noon with the usual mix of news and weather and sports and other things. Let me also mention that tomorrow morning on this program in the 10 o'clock hour, we will do one of our monthly regular shows. It's the pediatrics program, something that we do once a month, always on Thursday, with our guest, Dr. Robert Bocek. He will be here, and it's and kind of an talk to the doctor open line. It's your opportunity to call in and ask questions, discuss things, the kind of things that you could take up with a pediatrician, whatever's on your mind. If you have concerns for yourself, the kids in your lives, that'll be hour number one. Hour number two, we will be talking about about the life of the 41st president of the United States, George H.W. Bush, the father of the current president. And for that, our guest will be Tom Wicker. He's a former columnist with the New York Times, a man who has been covering American politics for a long time. And he is the author of a new brief biography of Bush that's part of the Penguin Brief Biography series. And we have, between us and the Afternoon Magazine, we've talked with a number of people who have written these biographies. The last one that we did was Martin Marty, who is a religious historian, and he wrote a biography of Martin Luther. And I know that on the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste Quinn has talked with a number of authors of these brief biographies. I think the idea is that the only qualification is that it can't be any more than 100 pages. And so tomorrow we'll talk with Tom Wicker about George Bush, Bush 41, George H.W. Bush. That's tomorrow. Well, we have a couple of people here ready to go. And as I said, we're certainly interested in your comments and thoughts about the hearing this morning and about the issue that was discussed. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers, as always. Well, let's go to the phones here. We have starting to get some folks lined up. First in line is a caller in Urbana, and line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I just wanted to say I listened to the hearings, and I thought it was very impressive that all of the senators were present and that they did have a thorough investigation and that they're taking it very seriously, as they should. I'm still kind of confused about the limits of the Geneva Convention. It seemed that the Army personnel there, the military personnel, were saying that this, the methods used were not in line with the Geneva Convention, and that they were instructed to do this here or at Guantanamo Bay. But it seems to me that there are some, there's a broader range of methods that are allowable that I think most people wouldn't be in favor of them using, but that the military feels that they need to in order to get the information that they need to protect us. So I was wondering, I don't know if there are any experts listening, but if anybody knows how far the military actually can go, what that, if they're able to define that gray area, and should we believe that this isn't happening at Guantanamo Bay?
Mm-hmm.
Those are my questions.
Well, though, you know, I think you raise a good question. And in fact, maybe you didn't have the opportunity to hear this conversation we had with this international law expert, this law professor that we had on last week. And I have to admit that it confuses me as well, because for what it's worth, she said the kinds of activities that we've heard described in the media, the things that the military did and some of the pictures that we have seen, she said, as far as she was concerned, that it clearly was a violation of the Geneva Convention.
Right.
And that there's also another convention that's called the Convention on Torture, which is another international agreement that the United States has signed. And both of these things we have signed, and so we have promised to abide by them. So that means not only that if an American soldier or an American should violate that, not only is it a violation of the Geneva Convention, but it's actually a violation of U.S. law,
right,
because we've signed it. But what confuses me, though, is some of the things that we have heard from the military that make it sound like they say, on the one hand, we have told soldiers clearly what the Geneva Convention says and what they can and can't do. And yet, though, I get this feeling that they think that some of the things that were done maybe were okay with the convention. And so, I mean, I guess I share your confusion about what the convention says and what was done, and was it or was it not a violation of the convention. And maybe, again, that's something that we can, on some of our programming, explore some more so that we could get a clear understanding. And I guess I'm hoping that there is, in fact, it is clear that it's not just something that you could have a disagreement on, and one person would say yes and one person would say, well, maybe, and somebody else would say no. I would hope that it would be real clear what you can and can't do. And, you know, as I've said here a couple of times, I share your confusion about where the line is here.
Yeah, because they are in fact trained to get information they need, and I think that training, it involves more than giving a lack of air conditioning or something, as they suggested. I think that it really pushes the limits of what we feel is acceptable, even in what's legal.
Yeah.
And I don't think that they're being fully honest with us about that. You know, when we're outside of that realm of the theater, as they call it, I think it's hard to understand what you do need to do. But I think that they should be honest about what that line is, and to define it in a way that's not only political but honest.
Yeah. Well, already we have, you know, the first person, just even this morning before the hearing started, the first person to be charged in a court martial, this was the man named Civitz, pleaded guilty. So there was no contest there to the charges, and he was given what was the most serious penalty that they could, apparently. So, you know, it could also be that as more information comes out and as more people are come up for charges, you know, then maybe some of these will be a little bit more clear, but it's certainly not clear now.
Yeah, well, it's good to know that, and I appreciate your attempt to address this over several shows.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Let me just tell people who are listening or who might just have tuned in. Earlier this morning, where most of our programming, part of Morning Edition and part of Focus 580, was preempted so that we could have these hearings. They were provided to us by National Public Radio, coverage of hearings of the Senate Armed Services Committee. And testifying were a number of top military commanders, General Abizaid, who is commander of U.S. Central Command, who, I guess, as I understand it, would be the overall commander for Iraq, than Ricardo Sanchez, who would be the commander of the multinational force in Iraq, and General Jeffrey Miller, who was the deputy commander for detainee operations. And they were asking, they were answering questions of the senators concerning the allegations of mistreatment of the prisoners. And obviously one of the things that the senators were concerned about is what kind of instructions were given to the soldiers and who was issuing the orders and how aware was the military that there were these allegations of abuse. So if you've been following this story, if you were listening to the hearings this morning, now we have a little bit of time here leading up to our usual close, market report, and onto the afternoon magazine. And often what happens when we have these little bits of time is we throw open the phone lines and say, well, tell us what you think. And particularly, we're interested in how you think we might, in our own small way, address some of these questions in our programming. So that's what we're doing here. Let's go to next caller, Champaign, line number two. Hello.
Thanks. Two quick points. One following up on the prior caller, just to add to what listeners might consider as they're thinking about what is appropriate, what is legal, and what is moral in terms of intelligence attempts to extract information. A couple of things are important to keep in mind. One is by the U.S. intelligence presence's own estimations in Iraq, 70 to 90% of the detainees in the prison there are not, shouldn't be there, have not been arrested for appropriate reasons and have no intelligence value. The next point is that several experts on torture have written in editorials in places like the New York Times that coercive torture techniques simply do not work for extracting information that is useful for military action. The information you get is based on ending the torture, not based on providing some kind of guidance to the occupying force. And the third is that beyond the Geneva Convention, our own commander-in-chief has said repeatedly that what the country is doing in Iraq, that is, he said lately, that what the country is doing in Iraq is spreading American values, the values of freedom and justice and the like. I'll leave aside the point that he has said we're doing God's work, because that's too bizarre for me to address. But this point about spreading these values beyond the Geneva Convention simply prohibits the kind of humiliation and torture that we've seen, regardless of whether it produces good information or not. There is a moral imperative that simply prohibits it beyond the law. My second point, and I'll try to be brief. I want to thank you for your coverage of the hearings. I think it's absolutely critical and important that the public hear as much of this as possible, and they're not going to get it on the Fox News channel, so thank you for that. One aspect of this that I'd like to see a little more coverage of is the sort of cultural aspect of this war in the United States. This may be a flesh-and-blood war in Iraq, but in the United States, because of the tone the administration has taken, it is largely a public relations battle. And we see evidence of this, particularly in rhetorical terms, with this administration calling the U.S.-led effort over there coalition forces, when everybody knows there is no real coalition. They talk about improvised explosive devices, and the mainstream media, including NPR, has simply swallowed that whole, as if improvised explosive devices are not, in fact, bombs. They just don't call them bombs. And the latest one is, and in this hearing, Elizabeth Dole emphasized this again and again, this idea that there are unarmed civilians in Iraq that deserve the sympathy of the American public when they come in harm's way. There may be unarmed civilians in Iraq that are slinging hash, but almost invariably they're from third world countries and they're subject to their own abuses by the U.S. military. There's been extensive coverage of that, particularly in terms of contractors from India. But the contractors that were killed in Fallujah were not unarmed civilians. Unarmed civilians brings to mind this image of a plumber or an electrician who's over there doing, as one of the senators put it, God's work. Well, in fact, what they are is mercenaries, mercenaries by the strict definition of the word, and they're over there to make money. They say $1,000 a day, and they're armed, and they're trained, and almost invariably they're either special forces troops or they're people that are trained from other mercenary involvement in places like South Africa, where there have been reports that people involved in squelching anti-apartheid activists in South Africa are now being employed by the U.S. military in Iraq. At any rate, I hope that your programs will continue to provide a critical eye toward not only the actual movements and actions of our troops over in Iraq, but also the rhetorical and cultural presentation of what's happening over there by our administration. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We certainly appreciate it. We'll just keep going here, and I think our next caller is in Spring Bay, and that would be on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I agree with everything that previous caller was saying, and I'm concerned about the real breakdown in media in America and the news gathering and all that. As just as an example, Michael Moore's movie Fahrenheit 9/11, I've heard a report that it's going to be squelched by Disney because they've got some political ambitions in Florida for a tax break or something. That's ABC News also, and I'm just feeling these days that journalists, people who have a voice, really have an obligation to speak up about this and to dig a little bit deeper. Now, I listen to NPR, I read The New Yorker, Seymour Hersh is doing a lot of good work, it seems. But what are your impressions, David, in terms of what role the media is playing and network news and stuff like that? And I'll hang up and let you talk about that. Thank you.
Wow. That's the question is so big, I'm not exactly sure how to address it. I guess I would say this is not particularly insightful, but that I think that some of the media is doing a very good job and some of the media is not. And that I think that it's up to people to be savvy consumers of media by doing what they can to seek it out. And I think that, unfortunately, that's the environment that we are in today, that it's not going to come to you, that you're going to have to go out and get it. And I think that you have to keep in mind that a lot of the media in this country is to start with a for-profit institution and that they're interested in making money. I think also that for all of the stuff that people say about media bias, that an awful lot of the media are clustered somewhere in the middle of the political spectrum and are not all that ambitious. And so that if you're really interested in seeking out a broad range of opinion and people who maybe are going to go out on a limb one way or another, then they're going to have to seek it out. And that there are people on both ends of the political spectrum who are willing to do that. And what it may take is if you have internet access using that, and I know that occasionally people have said to us, you're always talking about the internet, I don't have internet, and unfortunately everyone doesn't. But maybe then that means what you have to do is go down to the library and use that great community institution. It seems to me that the information that people seem to be hungering for is there, but that involves sometimes an awful lot of work on individuals' parts to go out and seek that out. And you can't get a complete understanding of what's going on just by reading The New Yorker or The New York Times or listening to National Public Radio, certainly, or watching network news. The pictures, I think, now are so complex. There are so many pieces that it takes an awful lot of time to go out and get pieces to the puzzle, and that you probably have to put them together yourself. I think that overall that probably is true, that generally speaking, the news media, and that's taking in everything, all of the news media, have not been tough enough in the questions that they've asked about the war and about the government and its motivation going into it. And I know that there are people on the right who seem to think that the media has been anti-war,
I just don't think that that's true. I think that we're obligated, it's part of our job, to try to ask hard questions, to hold the feet of government to the fire, and at least get them to give us the reasons for what they're doing. And then it's also, I think, the responsibility of news consumers and of voters to tell the government what they think. So maybe I'll leave it at that. I don't know whether that's useful or insightful or coherent. I'll just go on to another caller and see what other people have to say. Let's go here to Urbana in line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I just was struck maybe by some of the other calls. First, delighted at your coverage and listened to it off and on most of the morning. But struck by the fact that the woman who called earlier, you were talking about being confused, and then you kind of chimed in. It seemed to me that the elephant in the room was that there is no common sense distinction between what's being called by officials abuse and what apparently was policy. That if there's a distinction, it's something on the order of, well, you're ordered to strip people naked, but if you put them in a pile, that's abuse. Mm. Well, I mean, that obviously defies common sense. I'm sure that no international court properly constituted would accept that distinction. So it seems to me the real scandal is not, these seven characters who were caught in doing the things that we've seen, but the officials that clearly ordered behavior that's of a piece with that which is now being called abuse. I mean, keeping people hooded and stripped naked and so on and so forth. So this seems to me that didn't seem to really come out very much in the hearings this morning, that they were, the focus was on these events that we've seen depicted, how did they happen? Not who gave the order to strip people and why even now that the military won't back down on that and say, okay, well, we're not going to strip people anymore. We're not going to hood people anymore. No, these are acceptable policies, but don't worry, we only authorize them, when we really need to. Well, who has trust in that now?
Yeah. Well, I think you're right. I think that may be the big question, and it does seem to be the case that, at least from what I was hearing this morning from the generals who were there, they still want to spin it as just a few rogue soldiers. Although at the same time they say, that the responsibility should be followed all the way up to the chain of command, even if that includes me. I don't know who it was General Sanchez, I think, had said that. It still sounds to me like they're trying to spin it as just, it was a few people that was out of control. It was just in this one place. So I guess we just have to wait and hope that that we're going to find out that that reporters will continue to ask, that members of Congress will continue to ask. I don't know. I think your point, though, is well taken.
But, that's also that thing you mentioned about, the responsibility goes up to me. That's kind of funny, too, that one of them in their opening remarks said, I take full responsibility. And my first thought was, well, why don't you resign? I mean, what does it mean to take full responsibility for something?
Well, it seems to be saying, I take full responsibility, and I promise you it'll never happen again.
Right. Well, who's going to trust that? It's not clear. It's not clear not only that they didn't, take reasonable steps to prevent this from happening before, but in fact, it's not at all clear that this wasn't official policy.
Yeah. Well, again, I appreciate the comments.
Thank you for
Thanks
your coverage.
Thanks very much. Let's go to line number three. This is a caller in Champaign County. Hello.
Hi. Good morning.
Yeah.
My reactions are manifold, as usual, but one thing that was emphasized a couple of times, and maybe you understood who they were talking about. Now, there's a guy named Major General Jeffrey Miller who ran Gitmo, Guantanamo Bay, and he was going over, and the famous quote was he was going to Gitmoize the place. But they were saying that a line came up several times that the Red Cross was complaining about not detention in the prison, but detention at, capture sort of thing. Mm-hmm. That's the complaints that he was supposedly responding to. My understanding was that they said that Miller went there because of the response. Because of that. Now, that doesn't make any sense if he went to the prison. And the other thing I'd heard earlier, which no senator brought up, which was that the Red Cross had been kept out of the prison. They hadn't been getting lists of people, which is, you know, I think that's a Geneva Convention, that when you incarcerate, you provide a list to the Red Cross, and you, in a timely fashion, despite the fact that combat's going on, you eventually let people, the Red Cross, come in and, you know, talk to people and look around. Now, they supposedly weren't doing that, so how could the Red Cross make a complaint about a prison that they weren't, you know, inspecting, mm-hmm. other than the fact, well, we're not being let in? Now they supposedly are going to have an office inside the prison, the Red Cross is, but if they still aren't provided lists of the people, they don't know who they're going to be talking to. They don't, you know, they don't know what, you know, they can move people around. So it's still a matter of, you know, who do we trust to in the situation? But the thing that I was trying to emphasize was that they emphasized several times that Miller was there responding to not complaints by the Red Cross about the prison, but about the detention. Somebody mentioned Fahrenheit 911, and apparently there's a scene in there that Tom Shales from NPR talked about in his review, which was it captures exactly that. It captures a really brutal, you know, capture and, you know, humiliation at the point of capture, which the Red Cross, you know, had stories about from people that were observing it, and, you know, out in, but they weren't allowed into the prison. So how could the Red Cross make a complaint about a prison they weren't allowed to inspect? But things were obviously still already leaking out, because the fellow that released the pictures on a CD, when he was disgusted by it, that happened all the way in January, right?
Yeah.
But Miller went before that. He went in August and September. And again, he was supposedly responding to, I mean, these people up there characterize, unless I'm confusing my investigators, they have a couple of others. There's a Major General Ryder that went in October after Miller was there. He was also investigating prisons. But, you know, it's either one of those, and they claim that both of them went in response to the Red Cross complaint about detention at capture, and then they investigate the prisons. So, I mean, it doesn't make sense. A lot of stuff doesn't add up.
Well,
as opposed to these people being, I'll let you in. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Mm. I'm just saying that though. It seemed pretty clear to me that the complaints about, there was a Red Cross report complaining about treatment of the prisoner at the prison, and it was a result of the Red Cross actually having gone in there and looked at it, and that according to here, I got in front of me a story from today's New York Times saying that it reads like this: Army officials in Iraq responded late last year to a Red Cross report of abuses at Abu Ghraib prison by trying to curtail the international agency spot inspections of the prison. And they quoted here a senior Army officer who served in Iraq said Tuesday. So clearly, that says to me the Red Cross actually got in there. They said, look, here are some problems. And one way the Army responded by saying was, well, from now on, if you want to come back, you have to give us notice before we'll let you in.
They had been in earlier, and yeah, that was, I did misunderstand that.
Now, the other thing may also be true. I mean, they may also have complained about how people were treated when they were captured. But it also seems to me that they did actually go into the prison and were also complaining about that.
But did you not hear them several times say that they went in response not to complaints about the prison, but complaints about capture? Because I know I heard that at least twice.
I think that you're right.
And in spite of the fact that Kennedy did bring up the New York Times article, and I guess it's in the Wall Street Journal front page now today too. Mm-hmm. So, and then we have Imhoff saying, you know, we've heard 8 references to this article. Well, I mean, it's germane to the topic of discussion. Now, why wouldn't it come up? And it obviously contradicts it. I don't think the senators covered themselves in glory. I expect more from Levin, and I hope they're doing something right now in their secret discussion that's more incisive than we get to hear.
Yeah, I expected it to be a little bit rougher and a little bit more piercing myself. So maybe more to come. I don't know.
Yeah. Byrd actually did try to bulldog this thing about, well, where did these rules of engagement, interrogation rule of engagement that was posted on the wall with the insignia from the headquarters, even though it hadn't passed through headquarters supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
Though no one was asked whether it came out of a lower rank in his office. Actually, I don't remember hear that question because that did come up on another issue. Well, it was some other document was originated from the guy's office without his actually having been briefed on it or something. But this rules of engagement that was posted. Byrd tried to bulldog on that and say, well, you know, would this have to go before the Defense Department civilian office? And they equivocated a fair amount, and they eventually said not necessarily, but they didn't say that they actually didn't. I don't remember them explicitly saying that it hadn't. What it makes me think of the whole Gitmoizing thing reminds me of what else came out in the last couple of days. I guess Newsweek grabbed this one, the memo from the counsel to the president talking about Geneva Conventions are a little antique or something like that. I don't know how exactly put it, but it seems to me that that whole kind of discourse was widespread, and that's what set the stage for this. So as far as if there's going to be a document trail advising people to do absurd and obnoxious, humiliating, I go back to the idea that we're hearing about some of this stuff, but there actually still are investigations of the deaths. I brought this up with Marjorie Cohn, who I thought was excellent. Maybe people thought she was too much of an activist because in the very last minutes of the talk, she mentioned that she had been at a demonstration against the current abuses at Abu Ghraib. I don't know where it was, but she brought up quite a few good things, and I guess you need to balance it, but I think we should be hearing a lot of voices on this.
Yeah.
People from the Center for Constitutional Rights, some diverse opinions, as was heard last night. Anyway, you're coming right up to your top of the hour, I think, aren't you?
And yes, and we got to go. Well, I want to say thanks for the call, and
thank
I want
you.
To say thanks to everybody else. And again, we will do our best to continue to follow this in all the ways we can think of. If you have suggestions, you can let us know what you'd like us to try to do. And within the extent of our ability, we'll do that. For right now, we'll finish up. I guess just a reminder real quick that, again, tomorrow morning we will do one of those things that we do every month on the program. It's Children's Health. Dr. Robert Bocek will be the guest. He's a pediatrician. He's been doing the program with us for now many years, and it's your opportunity to ask questions, whatever might happen to be on your mind. That's as long as it has to do with pediatrics and children's health. That's hour number one. Hour two, we will be talking with Tom Wicker. He's a former columnist for the New York Times, has been covering American politics for a long time. He is the author of a new brief biography of George H.W. Bush, Bush 41, the father of the current president. And so we'll be talking about that tomorrow in hour two. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions and comments. And now we hope you'll stay tuned because up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about the disease plague with science journalist Wendy Orent. She's the author of Plague, the Mysterious Past and Terrifying Future of the World's Most Dangerous Disease. That follows the 1 o'clock news. Taking a